Today on The Grave Talks, The House of Wills. Sometimes a building just speaks to you. Something about it comes alive, reaches out, grabs your imagination and focus. For me, the House of Wills is one of those places. The haunting images of its decaying insides line many websites of both paranormal investigators and urban explorers. For many years, it was left to rot. And this time, many investigators and adventure seekers discovered something not so welcoming behind its doors. With a storied history that leads back to the turn of the century, what is now known as the Haunted House of Wills was once a German social club, speakeasy, hospital, and in its last incarnation, for many years, a funeral home. Rumors of murder, mafia involvement, and unsavory business practices plagued many of the owners while it was in operation. The interior architecture of the House of Wills is something straight out of a 1980s horror film. To me, it feels like an uncomfortable mix of mid-century modern with a touch of Roman imperialism, a dash of Victorian detail, and a hint of Egyptian pyramid. Mix in water damage, decay, and vandalism, and you have the perfect setting for a haunting. Today, on The Grave Talks, we discuss the history and some of the investigations and findings at the House of Wills with paranormal investigator Daryl Marston.
A lot of people think that the House of Wills actually started in like turn of the century, early 1900s. Well, the original part of the building, and I've got these facts from Patty, who is the caretaker, and Eric Freeman, who is the owner, actually started in around 1855, 1860. They're not sure the exact date. It was built by a mason. First, it was it turned into be a German social club that eventually it was a speakeasy. It was several things before it actually became a funeral home, which Mr. Wills bought and turned it into the funeral home.
So would that explain the architecture in the building? Because that's what really stood out to me more than anything the first time I saw it. And they granted they were abandoned pictures, but it almost felt more like a 1960s or, you know, mid-century almost-ish nightclub than it did a funeral home.
Yeah, and that's, you know, that's what you get when you're in there. I mean, it's when I was in there, last time I was there was 2 years ago. It was very dilapidated, falling apart because it's been sitting since 2005. When they actually closed the building down, it was a funeral home all the way to 2005. So when they closed the place down, it kind of, you know, went into disarray. Then Eric Freeman bought the building, I think around 2012. I'm not exact sure the exact date. And then he started fixing it up. He's putting money back into it. But yeah, there's a lot of places in the building. Like there's a bar area up in one of the, you know, one up in the upstairs, which has that disco vibe to it, or that, you know, 70s vibe. And there's a lot of rooms in there that have that vibe to it. Like, you know, there's a room with a whirlpool in it that's from like this late 60s, early 70s. So yeah, it's such a mix in that building. You get this great, like almost Greek architecture in some parts of the building. And then you could see over the years when the kids took over the business, they started adding their own part into it, where it came more like a party palace for them than it was an actual funeral parlor.
Such a bizarre feeling to that building. That is what stood out to me more than anything. Let's go back to when it was a German social club and a bar and all of that. What are the stories of it at that time? What was its reputation? What went on there?
Well, the German Social Club was more in the part of Cleveland where this building is located, which is now more of a ghetto than anything. It was a really strong German area of the city. So it became a German social club, and, you know, people went there to, you know, to socialize and to have parties and to drink and whatever they did in that time period. And then, it was kind of around the same time where it became a speakeasy. As well. So there was a crossover there for about 25, 30 years, from what I understand, where it kind of went from that German social club to a speakeasy. But the big thing was it was built by a mason. And he was a high standing Mason in the community at that time, and I think in Ohio, period. He designed this building, and it's such an energy draw when you're in there. You could feel the energy just the way he designed the building, the architecture of inside the building. It's hard to explain unless you've ever actually been in that building, what you feel. There's this, it's almost, I don't like to say the word vortex, because you can't prove a vortex, you can't do any of that, but it almost feels like you're in a vortex, and there's parts of the building where the energy is just so strong, it's like the building is alive.
Wow. As a social club, as a speakeasy, was it a friendly place to go? Was it a happy place to go? Was there any stories or records of anything questionable going on there?
I do understand that it was there was some organized crime going on there during the speakeasy part of it. I can't speak for the German social club part of it. There's not a whole lot of history about that part. It was somewhat of a hospital too at some point too. So, I mean, from like a 40 or 50 year period, it changed so many times before it became this great, huge morgue and funeral parlor that everybody knows it for. So there's some dark spots in history. Like a lot of people, like I was saying, a lot of people don't even realize that the building was actually, first part of the building was constructed in the mid to late 1800s, where most people thought it was around 1900. Well, I learned myself from Patty that the building was actually a lot older than I even expected. So, yeah, there's a dark spot on that building where a lot of people don't know what really happened there. We do know there was organized crime there. The mafia out of Cleveland was doing some stuff in there in the turn of the century during the speakeasy part of it. So, yeah, there's a lot of dark spots we don't know about that things could have happened. There's been a lot of, like, you know, folklore about people being murdered in the building. There's one known murder that did happen there, and it happened just recently I'm going to say 2008 or 2009. A man was shot to death on the front steps in a drug deal going bad. So that's one of the newer things that's happened in that building. There's been a history of rape in the building, and there's been black magic being practiced in the building, which is still going on to this day from what we understand. So there's a lot of dark history there, and you can't put your finger exactly on it because a lot of it's not in history books.
Such a storied history. You said it was also a hospital for a period of time. What are we aware of with that?
Go ahead.
I said, what are we aware of with that?
Like I said, it's part of that dark history. I mean, it changed so much up to the early 1900s before it became the funeral parlor. It's just hearsay, but there is records. I'm not 100% sure what the records are that show it was a hospital. I'm just hearing this from the owner and the caretaker that at one point it was a hospital, and I believe them because Eric Freeman has really dug into the history of this building. This is his baby. This is what, you know, he's invested a lot of money and time into. So I think later on down the road, we'll see more of the history of it come out. I don't think that I'm hoping somebody eventually writes a book about the building, because it's such an amazing experience for a paranormal investigator or just somebody who likes to investigate these kind of properties. There's so much there to learn, and I'm still trying to learn about it because so much of it is hidden. That what the things that happened in this building during the German social club, during the speakeasy, during the hospital period, it's such a dark, dark spot that none of us really know about.
Is there a reason, or does anyone have any idea or inkling as to why it changed so frequently into so many different things?
I think it went through a process of different owners. I think the state took over the building for a while. And then I think Mr. Wills, when he came in, he bought the property and turned it. He had a partner at the time. I can't remember off the top of my head the name of his partner, but they bought the building. They took it over and they turned it into the funeral parlor. I want to say around the 1930s, 1940s, and it grew into the Ohio, or I want to say, most of it's probably, it was, at one time it was the biggest morgue and funeral parlor in Ohio at one time. until up to probably around 2004, 2005, when the building actually shut down. Mr. Wills actually died in 1971, but his children took over the building, and then that's when things went into disarray, and there were some shady dealings going on in the building and partying, and that's what actually got him shut down.
It was shut down because of all those shady things that were going on in a funeral home?
Yeah, there was some stuff going on toward the end of it. Actually, the one child, well, he wasn't a child. I want to say he probably was in his 40s or 50s at the time, was killed by an Ohio police officer, or maybe I think it might have been a Cleveland police officer back in the early 2000s in a mall. I don't know what the incident was. There was some kind of altercation, and the man was killed. Well, his wife took over the business, and then she really ran into the ground where she was basically taking people's money for funerals and stuff like that and not processing the actual funeral. She took off to Florida. I think she was arraigned and brought back to Cleveland and prosecuted. And that's when the state took the building over. Then Eric Freeman bought it a few years later.
Wow. Are there any, those are clearly documented stories of how it ended. While it was in operation and being somewhat of a shady practice, it sounds like, were there any allegations of things not going as planned, so to speak? I'm just thinking of other funeral home horror stories that I've heard over the years of, you know, the body you bring in may not be the body you get in that urn. Allegations of anything of that nature that may cause unrest, anything along those lines.
Yeah, there's rumors of that. There's rumors of body stacking down in the morgue area and funerals being paid for by the insurance companies or by the loved ones and people not being buried or being cremated. There's stories of that. I don't know how truthful they are. I do believe some of them from what I hear. If you go back into, and it's not that far back, we're talking maybe 10, 15 years ago, this was going on. It's pretty documented stuff in Cleveland, so it's probably on the record book, something you can look up very easily to find out about the House of Bills. I've not gotten that far with it. I kind of walked away from the whole thing with it because it had such an impact on me when I was there. I'm sure we'll get into that later on here in the interview, but I had to actually walk away. Like a lot of people who've investigated this building and just say, I don't want anything to do with it anymore because a lot of bad things happen.
Really?
Yeah.
It's one of those places, I think, that when you see it, I mean, when I set up doing interviews, when I set up planning out shows, every once in a while, there's one place that just strikes me. And this place did that to me. And I don't know why. I mean, I love urban exploration pictures and things of that nature, because I never actually do that myself, but I love seeing what other people have done or where they've gone. I don't know if it was that, but there was something about that place that just was like,
I'm going to tell you, because I have my own show on Paranormal Warehouse.
Yeah.
The American Thunder Live Show. And almost every episode, and we do an episode a week, almost every episode, either from us, because I have four co-hosts, or our guests, that name of the House of Wills comes up by everybody, and they're because they know we've been there.
Yeah.
We've investigated the building several times, just as of late as just past June. We were there doing a live feed, and it's amazing because we were laughing about it the other day. Like, God, how's that come up every damn show? And it just does.
It draws people to it. For whatever reason, it really does. It's one of those unique places. How did you first come to know about it? What was your first discovering of this building?
By accident. I was in Gettysburg doing an investigation, actually doing two investigations with a guy who ended up being my partner in this whole thing. In Gettysburg, first time I ever met him, his name is Greg Knapp. He actually lives in Akron, which is maybe 45 minutes outside of Cleveland. We were in Gettysburg doing a thing. He said at the end of the night, about 4 o'clock in the morning, he said, "Hey man, you got to come up to Cleveland and do the House of Wills." I had never heard of it at that point. I was like, "Well, what's the House of Wills?" And he explained it to me. I was like, "This is just too good to be true." He'd obviously been investigating the building for several years and been there probably 8 or 9 times at that point. So I said, "Okay." And next thing I know, I kind of brushed it off. This was in June, and by July I was at the House of Wills. So, long story short, I'm at the House of Wills, and I'm invited there. Patty meets us there. She's the caretaker. Lets us in the building. It's not the best neighborhood. Anybody who's ever investigated this area will tell you it's just as scary outside as it is inside. You're fighting the surrounding area because they don't like outsiders. You'll be standing there. You'll be hearing gunshots and people driving by and yelling, and it's pretty intense. So we're there. And man, I walked into that building. Well, first of all, when the person let us in the building, the first thing they said, "Oh, we have to clear the building first." I'm like, "Clear the building?" I was like, "Yeah, we have to clear the building, make sure nobody's hiding in there." I was like, "Okay." And for people who've never been there, the House of Wills is huge. I mean, it's almost four stories, including the basement, and there's a sub basement as well, which is a fifth story. There's a basement in the basement. So we had to go room to room and clear this place to make sure there's nobody in there, because there's been people attacked. The caretaker was attacked by a guy with an axe a couple years before that.
Wow.
So yeah, it's an intense area, but it's even a more intense building. And it came to the point just this past November where I was interviewing Eric Freeman on my show, the owner, and he was telling me that, and this is all on YouTube, by the way, anybody wants to look it up. The community, there was a guy in the community who actually came out and was going against him and saying the House of Wills is causing all the bad stuff in that neighborhood. And he wanted him out and all this stuff. And they actually came in that building and tried to actually find him and take him out of the building. So, yeah, it's a pretty intense area. It's a tense investigation. I was there probably 14 hours straight locked in that building. And I tell you what, I came out of there a different investigator. And it really did a number on me for a good 3 or 4 weeks. I was not myself.
And I want to talk about your investigation here and about how that affected you in just a moment. I want to ask, do you know why did Eric, the current owner, decide to purchase it to begin with?
He said he worked in the city. He used to drive past it almost every day. And he felt a draw to the building. Every time he saw the building, he felt this draw to it, and he wanted to get in there. And then it came up for sale, and he got it for a really good price. It was for sale through the state or through the city, and he got it for a good price, and he purchased the building. And now he has this gigantic building that's falling apart. So this is about 4 or 5 years ago when he purchased it, and that's the reason he just said he always felt this draw to it. Now, I'm not putting out anything out there that nobody already knows about Eric. If anybody knows Eric Freeman, he is a high priest in the Satanic Church, the new Satanic Church. He's very out with that. He has no problem. I've known this for several years, and in the last couple of years, he's been very vigilant about saying, "Hey, this is who I am. This is what I do, and this is where I do it."
Mm-hmm.
So that you have that combined with all that history of that building, all the bad things, all the good things, everything that's happened in that building for the last 150 some odd years, and then you got the satanic thing going on there, which there are rituals have been done in the building. We've actually seen videos of them. And he'll freely admit to you what they do.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. I think that's one of the reasons he wanted the building as well. He could do with it as he wants, especially being in his position in the Satanic Church, mm-hmm. or I should say the new Satanic Church. He's not part of the old Satanic Church, which he left, and him and Anton LaVey's grandson started the new Satanic Church. So that's what they do there.
Is he open to the paranormal investigators and on good terms?
He was at one time. They've had a couple of bad things happen there with some groups, and now, be honest with you, it's shut down. We were the last ones to be in there, and we actually had to pull teeth for about 3 or 4 weeks straight to get in there. That was back this past June, mm-hmm. A couple months ago. we actually had a touch base with Eric. We had a touch base with the caretaker, Patty. And we've been good friends with Patty for a while now. And she actually got us in the door because Eric didn't really want anybody in there. Mm-hmm. There's been a couple shows done there. Ghost Brothers was there. They did their thing. And I think that's really where he got a bad taste in his mouth, because they really built it up to be this horrible place and evil. I don't know if it's evil, but it's not good. I can tell you that much. Mm-hmm. I can't say it's demonic because I don't like saying the D word, but whatever is in that building, it takes a liking to certain people, and other people, it will just totally F your day up.
Okay.
So whatever's in that building, I think a lot of it has come out because of the rituals that are being done there.
Okay. Almost like the pot's being stirred, where they may be there, they may be dormant, but they're being called back up.
Yeah, and Eric is, don't get me wrong, Eric does what he does. I don't judge him on that. Mm-hmm. He's a great guy. He was great on my show. He's very interesting. Patty, the caretaker, she's awesome. She's a great person. But now they're shut down and for at least a year, and they said they probably will not reopen to the paranormal. They're trying to make it into an art gallery in Cleveland, is what the goal is.
Okay. What were some of the first that you have knowledge of, and not necessarily from your experiences, but what were some of the first reported accounts of paranormal activity there that you're aware of?
I could tell you from a couple friends of mine who investigated the building before I did. I don't know if you're familiar with Resident Undead, Adam Kimball and Rebecca Kirschbaum and all them. They were there probably 10, 11, 12 months before we were. And they actually filmed an episode there. And I saw what happened to Rebecca. Something got a hold of her, puppeted her. When I say puppet, a lot of people don't realize what puppeting is. Puppeting is, I hate saying that, yeah, you've been possessed, because that's bull. I mean, that's bull. Puppeting is when something takes advantage of you and can actually, you're fully aware of what's going on, but you're being drawn into a certain area. I seen what happened to her on video, and I was kind of hesitant, I'm not gonna lie. And I actually interviewed Rebecca last week on my show, because we did MadCon with them up in Madison, Ohio. And I interviewed her on the show, and that's one of the questions I asked her about what happened to her at the House of Wills. I said, Rebecca, I ain't gonna lie to you. At first, I thought it was bullshit. I'm not gonna lie. Until I went there, and I had it happen to me. The exact same thing that happened to you. I was not ready for it. Whatever was there, it took control of me. And anybody's ever had this happen to them, they'll know what I'm talking about, where you can see what's going on, you can hear what's going on, but you do not have control of your body until you snap out of it. Like, you got to really snap out of it. Like, you got to tell it to get off of you. And the funny thing is, when we were doing the investigation, this is in July, it's probably about 85, 90 degrees in the building, 12, 1 o'clock in the morning, somewhere in that area, and you could see on video, you could see my breath, like it's 30 degrees outside. And I told everybody, I said, look, I'm not feeling good. Something's wrong. I feel sick. And all of a sudden, you get on video, you can see my breath coming out of my mouth. And we videotape. Everybody else is with us. There's three other people with me. None of them had, you could see their breath. And I got up the staircase, and I yelled at this, whatever it was, to get off me. And the guy who was videotaping from behind me, you can actually see a black mass or black shadow. It's like a half a second to shoot down the stairs, and I felt better. So that happened to me. I've seen it happen to Rebecca Kirschbaum. I know other people who've had happened to this girl Stephanie, who used to be on our team. I heard the stories of stuff happening to her throughout the years. It's like anybody goes in that building, they have the same story. At least one person on their team or who are with them has something like that happen to them, where this energy attaches itself to you. And it's not so much what you see in that building. It's what it gets in your head. It makes you see things. It makes you, like, it knows your darkest secrets. It knows what you fear. And it allows you to see that, which sounds crazy, but it's true. It happened to me, and I'm a big skeptic. I believe in the paranormal, but I don't believe every story everybody tells me. I have to see it for myself.
When that first occurred to you, when this thing was kind of taking over you, what was going through your mind?
Honestly, because it's the first time it's ever happened to me. It's only happened to me one other time in a very dark location in Kentucky, Anderson Hotel. It happened to me there, too. But it happened to me, that was the first time it's ever happened to me. When it happened, I honestly thought I was ill. I thought my stomach started hurting until I felt my arms get freezing cold and I saw my breath. It scared me. I'm not going to lie. It scared the hell out of me because I'm like, what is this? What is going on? Why do I feel this way? I could see everything going on around me. I could hear the people talking, but I was like in a complete daze, like a trance almost. And I dug deep down inside myself and said, hey, I got to get out of this. And I brought myself back and I yelled at this thing to get off me, and it did. And I didn't feel right the entire night. And literally every time, the times we've been in that building, you probably get about an hour into it and you have to go outside. You have to go outside, shake it off, and regroup, spend 15, 20 minutes outside, then go back in and restart your investigation, because it just, and that's everybody in the group it happens to. You have to go outside. You just got to get it off you because it's that intense in there.
What do you think it is? I mean, I know you don't want to use the D word, and I totally understand that, but what do you think it is?
I think it's something that's been conjured up. From what's been, you know, the practicing in the building of certain rituals. I hate saying the D word, but it could be. I don't think it is. I just think it's a very dark, strong spirit that knows how to manipulate people. That's how I suggest it, because I think if it was an actual demon, which, you know, is very rare, I think it would be doing more havoc. I think it'd be following people home and doing things to them, you know, in their life. But I there is stories of people who had, and it happened to me. It's something followed me home from there, and I was sick for, you know, a good 2 or 3 weeks. Where not sick like where I'm laying in bed throwing up, but sick like depressed. And I had nothing to be depressed about, and so I had to get my house cleansed 2 or 3 times, and I started feeling better gradually over a couple weeks. You know, people, I was reaching out to certain people in the field and saying, hey, what do I do about this? Because I've never had this happen to me. Where do I go? Who do I talk to? And people were reaching out to me and trying to help me, and they got me through it.
Was the time that you felt that puppeting happened to you?
Yeah.
Was that your first experience? Was that your first investigation there?
That was my first time there, yes.
Wow. Let's talk a little bit more about that first investigation. Obviously, that's quite an impactful thing to have happen to someone. What else did you find in that first investigation?
I want to talk about that, and I want to talk about we were there back in June, too.
I want to get to that, too.
Yeah. The first time I was there, it really effed with all four of us. There was four of us there. We were there by ourselves. And two of the people with us, which is Greg and Stephanie, they've been there several times, so they knew the history of the building. And me and Keith, who was another member of the team, we've never been there before. So it really, the first thing I saw, and I hate saying it like this because not only do I think I'm crazy, but we did a prayer outside. I've never done prayers or anything like that. I was not a very religious person. I believe in God, don't get me wrong. But, you know, they said, let's do a prayer. So we did a prayer. And I had a vision of me actually during a prayer, looking up with my other three teammates and actually pulling out a gun and shooting them. Right then and there, I'm like, what the hell was that? Why would I even think that? Why would that pop in my head? I don't think stuff like that. So I pulled the one guy aside and said, hey, Keith, I just had this vision, man. He said, dude, I had the same vision a little while ago. He's very skeptical. He said, I don't know what it is, man. He said, there's something about this building. So this is even before the investigation even started. It's still daylight out at this point. So we go into the building and very dark. I mean, it's pitch black in there in the middle of the day. It's insane. So we set up all our static cams, and this is when we used to do the whole static cam thing. You had a home base with the the monitors and everything going. We had like 10 static cams set up in this building as far as we could reach with our all extensions and stuff. So we're catching all kinds of little stuff moving around. And right in the hallway, right outside of home base, we set up a REM pod, probably about 10, 15 feet from the doorway. And all of a sudden, that thing, out of nowhere, before the investigation even started, just started going off. Like, what is this? We made sure everybody, you know, had their phones on airplane mode. And we, you know, I don't think we had walkie-talkies at that point. So we go out in the hallway. We're just looking at it. And we're telling it to do stuff, like, come closer, you know, do this, do that. Like, you know, usually most people do an investigation. And it was intelligent, whatever it is. You could see this dark mass at some points down the end of the hallway that was darker than the rest of the hallway. And you would see it move up, and you would see this REM pod go off. So we actually videotaped a lot of this stuff. And if anybody's ever interested, they can go on YouTube and look under Breaking Paranormal and watch the actual YouTube video. It's about an hour long of us there. And it's actually broken up into two different investigations, and they're about a year apart, and we kind of mixed it all together. All night long, just doing stuff in this building. We were getting responses on the SB11, the SB7, on EchoVox. We'd have them all three set up at the same time and getting the same responses on all three of these different, you know, spirit boxes. And it would tell us to, you know, go F ourselves or get the hell out of the building, or, you know, it didn't like us. It didn't want us there, whatever was there. But it wasn't just one voice that would come through. It would be several different voices telling us to do certain things. The one guy, Keith, he actually got scratched. He had three scratch marks going down from the top of his, I believe it was his left shoulder or his right shoulder, going down the center of his back. That happened in the bar area during the investigation. It's the same spot where it told me to go F myself and get the hell out of the building. It was pretty intense. When I saw daylight, I was glad to get out of that place and leave. I wanted to leave Cleveland so bad after that. I was ready to go.
That wraps up part one of our interview with Daryl Marston about the House of Wills. In part two, we'll discuss the possibility of it being a demonic haunting that plagues the House of Wills, or the possibility that it is just a very oppressed spirit set out to make life miserable for the living while in death. Either way, makes for a very uncomfortable, haunted situation. We will also dive into many questions about the House of Wills, including who some of the spirits are and why they choose to haunt the House of Wills, and learn about the rooms that no one wants to be in alone, and the dark reasons why. To listen to part two of our interview, become a Gravekeeper at patreon.com/thegravetalks. It's only $5 a month to become a Gravekeeper. For that, you'll get access to every single episode of our show as we create it, months in advance of their public release. In addition to that, you'll have exclusive access to our part two interviews, a whole second chapter of the show exclusively for Gravekeeper members. Patreon.com/thegravetalks to get all that and to help keep this program alive. Until next time for The Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Kristen Bell, and if you know my husband, Dax, then you also know he loves shopping for a car. Selling a car? Not so much.
We're really doing this, huh?
Thankfully, Carvana makes it easy. Answer a few questions, put in your VIN or license, and done. We sold ours in minutes this morning, and they'll come pick it up and pay us this afternoon.
Goodbye, Truckee.
Of course, we kept the favorite.
Hello, other Truckee.
Sell your car with Carvana today. Terms and conditions apply.